Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, podcast pedants. It's producer Mike here with another handy fact. Now, today's guest is a very successful TV presenter and producer, and now a best-selling author. And yet, he can't afford decent Wi-Fi. So, apologies in advance for the audio quality on some of today's interview. Don't blame me, Gov. I just edited the motherfucker.
Welcome to Namaste Motherfuckers, the only podcast where the worlds of comedy, self-help and business collide. I'm your host, Callie Beaton, and in today's episode, we're going to be looking at why you can never spend too much time watching television. A recent study found that viewers who binge watch TV shows report enjoying them less than those that watch one episode a week. That's a fact no one wants to hear. Watching action films makes you eat more than watching other TV shows. A bit like lockdowns made me eat more than a Marine just back from a special operation. Some American TV networks are speeding up repeats of shows such as Seinfeld and Friends by as much as 7.5% so they can squeeze in more ads. A bit like when I perform stand-up, slowed down by 7.5%, so I have to write fewer gags. One US county jail now gives its inmates black and white jumpsuits because orange is the new black made orange ones too cool. I'm a bit scared to say this next one in case I unleash a Trekkie backlash, but here goes. Not one of the Star Trek TV shows or films actually contains the words, "Beam me up, Scotty." So maybe I've put the record straight and Trekkies will thank me. I guess time will tell. And here's my favourite. Iceland's most successful reality TV show was called Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and it featured a live stream of four little adoptable kittens living in a tiny house.
There we go.
Do you like the way I blamed you? It's like you're a guilty angle. It was me.
That's my guest today, presenter, producer, and now best-selling author, Richard Osman. Richard and I have in common the fact that we both spent many years working as TV executives before, in his case, becoming a much-loved presenter of shows like Pointless, House of Games, pretty much a national treasure by now, and winner of Hart's Weird Crush Award. And in my case, giving up the boardroom to become a comedian, now trying to make people laugh, mainly via Zoom, during a global pandemic, begging for cash by a crowdfunder.
I've got slight feed back here. Can you hear me coming back twice? Oh no, I might be all right now.
I can't at all.
I suppose that's what feedback is. I didn't need to qualify that, did I?
I think it's fine. Between the two of us. Yeah.
Now, I should say before we kick off the interview bit of the podcast that despite having secured an unprecedented seven-figure deal for his trilogy of crime novels, The Thursday Murder Club, Richard's home tech setup sounds much like he's broadcasting from the lower reaches of Wookiee Hole. But hey, if you want glossy, polished Osman, you can get that every day on your telly boxes. This is raw, unfiltered, lockdown Osman as you've never heard him before. I talked to Richard about hit TV formats, growing up without a dad, gender, ageing, being a 75-year-old woman in the body of a 50-year-old white man, life, death, and the big questions. But I started by asking him about appealing to the mainstream versus being cool.
Honestly, I would so love to be cool. And relevant, and or you know, sometimes
you have got a black jumper and a quiff. I should say, for anyone who obviously no one can see you, but you're looking a bit yeah. Jack Kerouac today.
Oh, that's is that someone from a Jack Kerouac novel, yeah, or Jack Kerouac,
yeah,
himself?
I don't know what it, well, looks either like. One, but I was thinking more from a novel. So yeah, or somebody who could have kind of hung about while Bob Dylan played his guitar back in the day, something like that.
I was outside Turnham Green Tube yesterday, and the lovely Jeffrey Holland, who's played Spike in Heidi High, wonderful actor, said, "I have got a new nickname for you when I see you on television, Richard. It's Quiff Richard." I thought, okay, that's nice. Nice.
Everyone's a comedian, aren't they? We've all got time to be funny in this lockdown. Yeah.
No, not it. I don't have anything else I can do apart from be mainstream. You know, you have to make the sort of telly you want to watch. You have to make the sort of telly that comes from your heart. You have to write the sort of books that you want to read and that come from your heart. And I honestly, I would love to be, you know, you get sort of intellectual sometimes. If you ever turn on Radio 4 and there's like people chatting about something, you think, oh, wow, where have you come from? This is amazing how you're speaking about things. And I can't do it. It's not for me. So what I try and do is the stuff that I love, which is mainstream, I try and make it as good as possible and as funny as possible and as smart as possible. But I'm not trying to dumb down, or I'm working at the limits of my intelligence at all times, I assure you.
I think you're being quite self-deprecating, because there may be types of intelligence that all of us struggle to have. We all notice the types of intelligence we don't have, right? And we take for granted the bits we do. Yes. Because to us they're just part of us. But one of the things, people talk a lot about your tweets, and you are, do you think that's the optimal format for you? Do you think you've got like the attention span and the wit? You're like, I can do that number of characters and now I'm going to go and watch the snooker. Is that how it is to be inside the Osman house?
Oh my goodness. Well, that's like being inside the Osman brain. You've got it. My good friend Lucy Prevost talks about intelligence, and she said, well, look, the thing is, there's different types of intelligence. There's speed of intelligence, there's originality of intelligence, and there's depth of intelligence. And I think I've got speed of intelligence. I can come back with a one-liner. I can see stuff quite quickly and work out what's going on. I think I've got some originality. I've got no depth of intelligence. Someone like Lucy does have huge, you know, she can just go off and look at something for 6 months. People I went to university with who are now professors, the cleverest person I know is a guy called Professor Alan Finlayson. He's at UEA. And Alan, you know, you wouldn't put them on a panel show because he's not going to riff with Lee Mack. But, you know, if you want to know what's going on in the world and what are the kind of undercurrents that are dragging us forward into the future, Alan's your man, because he looks into the world in such incredible depth. And that's the kind of intelligence that I admire. I was about to say aspire to, but I long ago decided not to aspire to it, because if you haven't got it, you haven't got it, right?
Well, you probably, you might, it's also about choice, right? You decide, if you think, I interviewed John Lloyd a couple of weeks ago for the podcast, and he also talked about having, you know, he can talk about anything, you know, for 30 seconds, but don't try and get to talk about it for half an hour, which again, I thought was slightly unfair on him. But obviously that's the whole QI model, right? You look at things that are little bits of trivia and you delve into them from a lateral angle, and they please people in a sort of quaint, reassuring way.
And you remembered one thing that you can talk about, and hinting at depth is the big secret. If you can hint at depth, which you can, you know, it's fascinating now. We've got a prime minister who, for as many faults, has speed of thought and originality of thought, and he can express himself, okay? He has no depth of thought. He has no work ethic. He has no ability to work hard. He has no ability to look into the long-term consequences or something. Sometimes people say to me, would you ever go into politics? And I say, you know what, I wouldn't, because I'd be like Boris Johnson. I mean, with different politics, but I wouldn't be able to stay the course. You know, I don't have the concentration span. I don't have the ability to look at the things in the depth that very smart people do. But those are the people we're now rewarding in society. And on telly, it's fine. You're a comic or a presenter, it's speed of thought, originality of thought, that's all you need. But in politicians, it'd be nice to have a little bit of depth of thought.
Be nice to have it, although don't you think that you and I are somewhat to blame for Boris Johnson? And I'm just going to explain why. I'm guessing neither of us voted for him, but I know that you have talked a lot about, you're kind of a defender of reality TV. I'm also something of a defender of reality TV, not least because I suspect it's reality TV formats that have in part paid for each of the places from which we are having these conversations. So we have to be careful not to bite the hand that fed us. But if I think there's something about these big, loud characters, even if we hate them, we kind of love to hate them. I noticed when Trump kind of came out of the White House, much as I've spent, you know, the last 4 years winding myself up into a fury every day when I read the, you know, headlines and see him in them, when he was gone, I felt a bit like one of the late show monologuers, thinking, like, well, what do we get aerated about now? So do you think that there's the way in which society's got quite sort of polarized, and we've got these big, loud, charismatic characters without much behind them, that is something that's represented also on television, isn't it?
Yeah, it's represented on television. I don't think television caused it. I don't think when people say, oh, all started with reality TV, I don't believe that's the case. And certainly if you look at most early reality television, the moral really was that the underdog would usually win. you know, you'd watch a Big Brother or something. And the louder you were, the more likely you were to be voted out, to be kind of found out. And it was a wonderful place for underdogs, you know, and always was. And also a very wonderful place. I agreed to do an interview at the Labour Party conference years ago. It was down in Brighton, and that's my hometown, so I was happy to go. And I said, listen, you've got reality TV to thank for why people like Corbyn, because the one thing a reality TV audience understands is authenticity, right? And people say, oh no, but it's fake, the producer's fake. You think, these people are watching 24/7, these people. They understand authenticity. They might like someone or dislike someone, but they know when they're being truthful to themselves. So Jeremy Corbyn, whatever you think about him, he's been true to himself. So he has an authenticity, which is why that generation, I think, why he appealed to them quite so much. And I think that reality TV, again, you know, the criticism is always, oh, it's manipulated. And if I tell you what was manipulated, those documentaries in the 70s by, you know, Oxbridge people who were sort of going onto housing estates and then cutting these documentaries, making people look a certain way. That was manipulated. Reality TV is about as unmanipulated as you could have got back then. And now documentaries have caught up, and now documentaries are far more kind of fly on the wall and true to life. And, you know, it's, yeah, I think it's unfairly maligned reality TV, I have to say.
What is it about middle-aged white guys and technology? So sorry about the sound quality, motherfuckers. I used to get, because I worked on The Real World, so that was the very first reality TV show in my book. I know that you worked on Survivor, which certainly was the first reality TV show that brought in the sort of voting off and more sort of strategic thinking, and also then pitted different personality types against each other. When I look back at The Real World and Road Rules, which we did used to sell around the world, you know, they did, and this was back in the sort of, late 90s, actually, when we did that. And they were very innocent, and it really was just, I get a chance to be a voyeur in an innocent way. I just get to see what people my age are doing. And then obviously everything became more structured, and we started looking at what, and that's when people started to say, is it contrived? Is it real? And certainly when I worked on the MTV formats like Geordie Shore and X on the Beach, I was always kind of being asked to go onto panels and defend the fact that they weren't entirely contrived. And I guess you would be a sort of an advocate for saying, no, it's not contrived. It's letting the best man or woman win.
Listen, life is contrived. You can say, oh yeah, but listen, you've set this program up and, you know, they wouldn't really be running this bar. You think, we go to work every day. What do you think that is? That's a contrivance.
It's an abomination that you and I try to avoid. So that's what it is.
But you know what I mean? We're constantly being put in these situations in life because we're told, you know, capitalism tells us that we all have to go to work and we have to sit in an office with 15 other people. And that's false, but, you know, it's real life. And I think that certainly the generation that grew up with reality telly understands that. You know, there's a probably our generation, we look at it just go, but this is nonsense, and there's all sorts of rules, and they're doing, you think, yeah, but the viewers, they all know that, so they know that, and they're looking underneath it because they see that it reveals character, which is the fascinating thing about lots of reality TV. These days I think it does less. These days reality TV and celebrity TV have merged into two. You can see that, and it's, you know, a lot of it is just sales. But back in the early day, you weren't seeing, you know, interesting, you know, you can learn more about human nature from one episode of Come Dine With Me than you can do from most kind of high budget dramas.
And do you think that if you look at the sort of shows that there are and the ways in which these things evolve, do you think people's real self has to show through? That's the mistake people make. I think you've produced reality shows. I've worked on them too. And I think people really think, you see people burst into the Big Brother house or onto, you know, Love Island, being a way they've decided they're going to be, this is going to be my TV persona. And then really quickly, usually within the first day, their real characteristics have come through. And I sometimes thought, sorry to keep talking about Trump, he doesn't deserve the airtime. I'm sure he won't be listening to this. But one of the things that struck me about him was you could just see behind the curtain that he's always said the right thing in the room. So wherever he was, he said the thing that room wanted to hear. And until he was in the public eye, it didn't matter, because he could say something completely different in the next room and convince them. And that's how he hustled his way through life. And then suddenly he's on a world stage and we're going, hold on a minute, you've said seven different things. things that are completely contradictory just to charm the room. And there's a sort of element, isn't there, of us becoming ourselves, whether we mean to or not?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I always think quite often people come off like I'm a celebrity and say, oh, I was edited so badly. Honestly, there wasn't anything like it. And you think, I know the people who make that show. You, if anything, you were edited to make yourself look less boring than you were. You know, you went there, you didn't do anything. You were slightly passive aggressive. You're not the human being you think you are. You didn't come across well. And so in the edit, they sort of chopped you out quite a lot.
I'd love to know who was in your head when you just said all of that.
Oh my God. I mean, who isn't in my head? But you know what I mean? It's when we go on television shows, it's very easy to present one side of ourselves, you know, but if you're on a TV show for half an hour, it's easy to be your public image. It's very hard on those shows for someone who is a fake to get away with it, which is why people who are genuine tend to win them, because they have a consistency of personality. And that's the thing, you know, that's why the betting for those shows is always so ludicrous, because at the beginning, the people who are the most popular are always the lowest odds, and they're the most famous people. And by the end, it's just the person who was the nicest.
A decent, kind human wins out.
Yeah, the person who stayed the course. But, you know, that's, you won't read that in the newspapers.
That doesn't sell. That's not good copy. And do you think you're somebody who, I think you're a self-confessed introvert, or you're certainly not, you wouldn't bill yourself as an extrovert. And people seeing what you do might be surprised to hear that in some ways, and we'll come on to your writing and your book. In some ways, being a writer, which I know is how you started in telly as well, but in some ways that makes sense, perhaps, for somebody with your personality. But then you're also very much out there being yourself. So it is you and your personality that is, you know, in that place on Pointless and out there, you know, doing all the things you do in the public eye. So how do you square up introvert, extrovert?
Well, firstly, you're right about that. I wasn't even on telly till I was 40. And so, and I'd already sort of, bluntly, I'd sort of made my money by then. So I didn't have to do anything that I didn't want to. So I was able to just be myself. And I only take on shows where I think I can be myself. So that's useful. But secondly, I'm quite an alpha introverts. I'm quite an alpha human being, but I spent my whole life 6 or 7 walking. People look at me in the street, whatever happens, endlessly. My whole life I felt an outsider and I'd get stared at. And actually going on television, funny enough, I don't feel any more exposed walking down the street than I used to, because everyone looks at me again, but at least some of them now are going, oh, that's the guy from TV, rather than going, wow, look how tall that guy is. So I think introversion was never an option for me, because I would stand out of any crowd. And so it didn't make a huge amount of difference to me, but at least now I sort of feel like I'm getting noticed for something slightly more positive rather than just for being different.
I don't know why you didn't just move to Amsterdam or at least the Netherlands. I've got various friends your height. As you know, my kids are half Dutch, and you'd fit really well there. Or you could have had your kids with a very tall Dutch woman and have had the most enormously tall kids ever heard of. So you missed life decisions there.
There's still time. I'm only 50.
That's true, you're 50 and single. I want to talk about, you've mentioned the elephant in the room, which is since I last saw you, have turned 50. You've always seemed to me to have quite impeccable timing. You know, you got out of TV behind the scenes when you decided you'd made lots of hit shows and had had enough of that. Then you managed to pull out the bag a really impressive, you know, 10 years presenting. That 10 years hasn't ended. And then you've started to be a successful author. So your timing's always been impeccable, and you moved up a vaccine category neatly before the vaccines were rolled out. So I think you are a genius. You're always
I could not have turned 50 at the time. I was so delighted. I mean, because listen, it's as you'll find out in 7 or 8 years' time, Callie, it's depressing turning 50, and this has been a cherry on it. It's been a nice little bit of icing on the cake.
You see, you've talked about your 40s, I know, as such a positive decade. I've actually had a slightly reverse thing, which is I found my 40s really, really difficult. And I changed direction at 45, so and you at 39, I think. So I thought I was, you know, you thought you were late to the party. I was very late to the party. And my 40s were quite lost and unhappy. And I don't know, as you know, for women, there's also all the kind of hormonal upheaval, which does start much earlier than people talk about, although luckily people are talking about it more now. But I found that really hard. And then turning 50 felt like a massive relief. And I just remember literally waking up the next day feeling better about myself. And I'm only a couple of years in, but I'm loving it so far. So I'm wondering, you know, because you had your midlife crisis quite quite early, didn't you? You had yours. When would you say yours happened? You were very precocious with it.
Yes, exactly. I was way ahead of the curve. Funny enough, I was talking to a very good university friend of mine the other day, and she was an alcoholic, and in her early 30s, she gave up booze, still giving up, and everyone's incredibly proud of her for doing it. So she had her crisis early 30s, which is probably when I had mine as well. And we were sitting chatting, and we were looking at the wreckage of a lot of our friends around us who are in late 40s and what have you, and said, maybe we just got our awful crisis out of the way at the right time in your early 30s. You know, we both went through a bad time. And we seem very, very happy now. And we see, you know, obviously life is as challenging as it's ever been, but we have a kind of self-belief and a calmness, and we've done a lot of work on ourselves. And it's fascinating to see now other people sort of having to go through the same thing that we went through very early. But yeah, I wonder, and I know it's a truism, but it seems like the 50s for women is kind of like the 40s for men in some ways. Just that decade where, whether with men it's the testosterone is worn off a tiny bit, I don't know if it's that, and so one becomes less competitive. And with women it's various different issues as well, but that feeling that maybe you can be yourself a little bit more, and your public face is not the most important thing, and you know, it's you kind of feel a bit more love for yourself, I suspect.
It's also lovely to defy stereotypes. I think there are still so many stereotypes about what happens to women at a certain age, and that men grow into themselves and become, you know, more and more handsome and rugged, and that women sort of lose it at a certain point and are redundant. I think there's a whole generation of women really joyously disproving that. You know, when that guy, that French Yannois, that guy said that thing about women at 50 being invisible, upon which I dined out and did a whole Edinburgh show. But I think there were so many women, sort of, it was lovely to have the opportunity to say, for all of us, to say, no, look, you're not quite right about that. But do you think, you said you've worked a lot on that, because you had, without getting too sort of Freudian about it, but you're a man who grew up without a sort of male role model, certainly in the form of a dad from quite young, right? You were 8 or 9 when your dad left.
Absolutely.
So that has an impact, I imagine, on your sense of, you talked about being tall and that impacting your sense of belonging. But being a sort of outsider, how is it sort of learning how to be a man without having had that sort of effortless male role modelling inside the home, which I know lots of people listening will have been in a similar boat?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's I have no interest in doing a woe is me thing about men. Because listen, we're aware of the privileges that our gender prefers upon us. But yeah, listen, it is hard, and you know, I think that I think in my heart I am quite testosterone driven. You know, so I feel like I am quite male.
You mentioned testosterone a lot. It's obviously been a long lockdown for you. You're like, I mentioned my testosterone.
But you know what I mean. So, but I'm not one of those people who would. I think I have some stereotypical male characteristics, and those things you have to harness them to use them for good. It's the truth. And so I can feel, when I see masculinity sort of unharnessed and, you know, unworked on in the streets, I recognize, I sniff it in the air, you know. So I'm not thinking what on earth's happening here. I'm thinking I see exactly what's happening here. And you know, I do think it's having strong, kind male role models can be very, very useful. It doesn't have to be a father, of course. I mean, if you've got a great mother, you were born, you know, you won the lottery of life. But you know, it's useful to see role models in society, male role models who are strong but gentle, strong but kind. You know, my grandfather was that. He's a police officer. He was very strong but gentle, and you know, that's the thing. But yeah, there's a deep immaturity to being male. Women mature a lot quicker than men, and men are very immature. You know, I absolutely buy that. And that's a problem for women. It's also a problem for men. You know, it's not fun. It's not a good thing to be. If you're a sociopath and you can use it and gain power, great, you can be immature for your whole life. If you want to be a useful, decent member of society and be taken seriously, it's quite hard to be immature. You know, it's quite hard to know that you're not quite getting stuff.
It's helped you, though, it's helped you to have an inner 8-year-old, though, hasn't it? If you look at the things you've created, and you're all about sort of fun and play and you seem to have a sort of playfulness. I know, you know, when you talk about things, it's like, well, is it fun? You know, you're driven to do things that actually are fun, and you were lucky enough to find a job pretty much out of uni that suited you. You know, it was fun. It was using all the bits of your brain that kind of worked on the sort of gaming, and not as in gaming, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, but games and puzzles and fun. So there's got to be, I know that's something I found really hard when I started out in comedy, that bit later when I'd had to be really responsible for a couple of decades and bring up kids and have a good job. It was really hard to just sort of giddy about and be a laugh. The times that stuff I've done on stage and on screen hasn't worked, when I forgot to be playful and I was so busy being like, well, I've learned it and I've written it and I'm really going to take this seriously and everyone's paid to be here, and everyone's like, oh, well, it wasn't a lot of fun, Callie, but well done. Like I was trying to get a certificate for achieving so well as a stand-up. But it seems that you have access to, don't take this the wrong way, to being an 8-year-old quite readily.
Funny enough, I tweeted the other day because I was watching the snookers on, and I had some mini eggs, and I said, you know, 10-year-old me visits from the past, says, what are you up to? I say, oh, I'm watching the snooker eating mini eggs, and 10-year-old me says, oh, same. Then 10-year-old me said, do you still fancy Kim Wilde? And I said, yeah, of course. And that's nice. And this, I think because my dad left when I was 8, there is a huge disconnect there and a huge gulf. And so the 8-year-old me and the 50-year-old me have a continuum, you know, we're very in touch with each other. You know, I just had to do a lot of work on the bit in between, I think. But it's wonderful to still have, to be able to access your playfulness and your childishness and your wonder at new things. And, you know, I still listen to the charts every week. It's ridiculous. You know, I like new stuff.
Is there an age between 8 and 50 when men learn to piss in the toilet instead of on the floor?
Well, post 50, of course, you can have a sit down week, which is the greatest joy of all. I honestly, this whole toilet thing, I've never weed on a seat in my life. If I ever have, it's been wiped down straight afterwards. And any time a woman has to use a loo after a man, and they go, oh, I can't believe it. I had to go into the loo and there's a guy who had used it. It was disgusting. And you go, yeah, we've had that our whole lives. Every single toilet I've ever used, I've had to use after a man. You want to be a man and have to use gender toilets. It's no more fun for us. They're not going in and go, oh, brilliant. Smell of excrement. And there's wee all over the seats. I'm in my natural environment in the jungle. Yeah, we hate it as well, but we have to do it all the time. It is, but occasionally, like at work or stuff, there's I can't understand why someone's weeing on the seat and not cleaning it up.
But I think they must be doing it at home as well, because I always used to think, well, I'm sure you wouldn't do that at home. And then, well, mind you, now sharing a house with only males, which I never thought would be the case. I am wondering if there is an age when they sort this out. But obviously, I'm just sharing a house with the wrong people. Namaste, motherfuckers. I wanted to talk about your book, which I have just finished, and I won't quote the text I sent you because it would ruin the whodunit. But it, suffice it to say, it was a surprise, and I was really pleased about who's going to be in the next book. But I just wanted to start at the end, which is always a lovely place to start, with your acknowledgements. And I did actually read them after reading the book. I know some people may have forwarded straight to them, but I thought they were really, for somebody who doesn't always strike me as, I mean, you are earnest, but you're also quite playful. And I'm not sure that being sort of really earnest and vulnerable is the most comfortable place for you. And it seemed to me that in the acknowledgements, you really did have those qualities evident. And I actually found it quite touching reading it. And if I may, I'm just going to quote from one bit that you said at the end of your acknowledgements. I'll end, if I may, with the big guns. Thank you to my mum, Brenda Osman. I hope that, amongst other things, there is a sense of kindness and justice running through the book. And that, of course, comes from you. Gives me little goosebumps, Eve. I feel like I know Brenda. But that seems quite an un-you thing to have written. Not that there's a side to you, but I can't, there's something very almost unshowbiz about that, isn't there? It's kind of like, this is where I'm from and this is what matters.
Yeah, listen, I think I would love to be more earnest than I am. You know, earnest people get stuff done. But at the same time, you can't be earnest all the time. And, you know, on Twitter, occasionally you get people endlessly tweeting aphorisms about the world and about being kind and care. You think, all right, come on, entertain us as well. And so when you do show that emotion, I think, you know, it's more interesting. But yeah, I mean, I'm driven by that stuff. I'm driven by that sense of kindness. I'm driven by very, very vulnerable emotions. But it's not something I would like to lecture about, because we're all driven by that sort of thing. I think it's worthwhile reminding people sometimes, especially the people you love, and telling them that. I think that's really, really important. But honestly, I'd rather be entertaining people most of the time.
I think it's that balance between entertaining and being vulnerable, isn't it? I certainly know that making my money as I do now, largely as a kind of public speaker and an after dinner speaker, that showing some vulnerability and some flaws fairly early on in what one says gets yes. the audience on side. Nobody likes to see a smug twat standing up on stage going, well, here's how you do it. And I'm really rather marvellous. One day you might be like me. So there is a sort of, which can also veer into sort of disingenuous self-deprecation, which is quite popular, yes. isn't it? People sort of say, yes, I'm terrible at this.
I couldn't,
yes, and I didn't, and I never would. But it sounds as if you're not, do you have imposter syndrome? It's very fashionable at the moment, isn't it? Ever since Michelle Obama brought it back onto the mainstream. But do you think you do feel like an imposter?
Well, everyone feels like an imposter, don't they? Because there's probably about 8 people in the world who don't. And
they're running most of the world, unfortunately, but yes.
Well, they're sort of, by and large, they're not. You know the people in our industry who don't have imposter syndrome, and they've stayed at the same level of the industry forever and ever and ever and ever. And they sort of facilitate meetings with each other. They all work for big organizations, and every week they have a meeting about how can we synergize between our two companies? What can we do with the rights to this program? And you think, you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
You are literally doing nothing. And they very happily take home a big paycheck. And I don't think they give it a second thought.
And we will be naming them in the show notes, folks.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Do tune in for those. It's all right for you. You can alienate everyone in the TV industry now, Richard. Some of us have to, you know, have to keep paying our dues.
It is lovely being able to do that. I never would, but it's you know. So I think that I think everyone has imposter syndrome, and I think that the only cure for it, firstly, is to accept everyone's got it, and secondly, to know that, you know, the truth is you are an imposter. You're not that good. You know, so do your best work, do your best possible work. If people like it, great. And if people like your next one, great. But, you know, no one's owed a living. Be kind, work as hard as you can, do good work. And you'll soon find out if you've got imposter syndrome or not, you know, because stuff starts happening when you do good work, I think that's the case. It's much harder. Of course, there's a structural thing built into it, which is, it's very easy for a man to say that because our barriers to entry to success are much lower. And if you're a woman with imposter syndrome, you're constantly being reinforced that you're not good enough, you know, which doesn't happen to men. So I think that to a woman with imposter syndrome, you have to say, look, everyone's got it. And hopefully you have allies who are reducing your barriers to be just as incompetent as any man you work with.
I think that's why it's quite helpful when successful men and women talk about it. I think vulnerability and imposter syndrome are quite important for people who are perceived to have all the answers to talk about. It's interesting, isn't it? Imposter syndrome was, I interviewed Oliver Berkman recently, and I think he was quoting from somebody else, but the idea that imposter syndrome is comparing our inner dialogue with someone else's outer dialogue, which obviously is never going to square up, and for us to remember that, because it takes a lot of effort to look effortless, right?
It's that social media thing, isn't it? When they say you're constantly comparing your blooper reel with someone else's highlights reel. And my best friend who I bubble with, she spends her entire life on Instagram. And she's always saying, oh my God, so-and-so, she's got such a wonderful life and her marriage is incredible and their house. I go, if her life and marriage was that great, she wouldn't be posting on Instagram 8 times a day pictures of how wonderful her life is, by the way. Because the one thing you know is if someone's telling you something about themselves, that's the thing that's not true.
Or it could be people like us who are single deciding that that is the way it must be because there can't be anyone who's found all the answers and posted.
But you get to our age and you know enough people that you've seen these stories come and go. You know, especially people in the public eye who you know, and you just go, I spoke to you last night and you were not as happy as you have been.
You wanted to put him in a shed at the end of the garden and never see him again.
You're talking to me about your marriage, and it sounded like it was in a lot more trouble than the pictures of you in your farmhouse on Instagram are telling us.
It's nice to have a big farmhouse in which to be unhappy, though. But hey,
oh, yeah, for sure.
Do you think, in terms of writing the book, I was struck by the fact that you obviously got a seven-figure advance that was much written about at the time. Probably lots of people going, yeah, but it'll be shit. And then everyone was like, oh, bugger, it's good and it sold well. So, you know, those of us who thought, you know, you were due a bit of a fall, we were very disappointed. I wasn't one of those people. I did wonder, there were a lot of chapters. I wondered, were you getting paid by the chapter? Is that why there were, what was the idea about the structure? How many chapters are there in book one of the Thursday Murder Club?
It's roughly 1,000 words a chapter, and that's because that's how I write. I do 1,000 words a day, and because I'm quite goal oriented, I try and write the whole chapter in that time. And because I'm from telly, I sort of feel like I need to be moving on to the next thing. So it was sort of accidental, really. It's just because that's how I wrote, and I didn't want to be halfway through a chapter and then come back to it tomorrow. My brain wouldn't compute, so I try and do a beginning, middle, and end every day. And yeah, then it comes out and everyone goes, oh, well, it's got these short chapters. And it's like the Da Vinci Code had short chapters. Wow, did you study the Da Vinci Code and think? I went, no, literally, that's my concentration span is 2 hours. In 2 hours, I can write 1,000 words, and 1,000 words is a chapter. So it's entirely accidental, but I do think it makes it very readable. I do think it makes, you know, you constantly have to turn the page and, you know, holding people's attention is a big thing, but it comes through my lack of concentration, which is good. My lack of attention span has been rather useful.
I wonder if all the great authors of all time would have had similar answers as to why they structured their books in a certain way. You know, I could do 2 hours, then I needed some cream eggs. I had to do a couple of tweets and I was done for the day. So that's...
Yeah, but you know what? All authors would tell you that. You know, Dickens wrote the way he wrote because he was writing for money and he was writing...
And it was serialised.
Yeah, it was serialised the next month. So that's why, and he's the greatest novelist in the English language, pretty much. Listen, your personality is your writing. Part of your personality is your attention span, I think.
And did you say, again, in your acknowledgements, you will now start to think that's all I read, but I promise it isn't. But I can quote from them liberally. Mark Billingham, when you were talking to him about writing the book, and he said there are no rules to writing a crime novel, then proceeded to give you two rules which you live by. Are you able to disclose those rules?
No, I talked to Mark, I'd say to Mark, Mark, you'd be able to do such a lucrative lecture tour at some point. At some point, I will say what they are with Mark's blessing, but they're quite prosaic. And so I said, the thing with Mark, I said to Mark, you know, we both of us get asked it now at things. And I say, the longer we leave off before we say what these rules are, the more disappointing those two rules are going to be when people discover them. Do you know what? When you're at the start of a creative project, sometimes someone just says one sentence to you, unlocks something in your brain. Mm-hmm. You know, and anyone who's sitting at home doing something creative now, we've got a big project, you know how much you have to fool yourself in those early days. You know, you really have to creep up on yourself. And anyone who just gives you that one sentence that just says, okay, for the next week I can sit down and I know where I'm going for a week. And then 1 week becomes 2 weeks, and then that becomes a month, and that's 2 months. And, you know, it's the only way to do certainly a book, which is the hardest thing I ever did. So sometimes it's just... someone says something that resonates with how your brain's working at that moment, and he certainly did that.
And is it the hardest thing you've ever done, writing the book?
Yeah, really, really hard. And, you know, it took me a couple of years. And I genuinely, you know, I like everything I do to be successful. And this is the first time ever when I finished it, I thought, even if I show this to an agent and they say, this isn't great, and nothing comes of it, I would have done it. And I'd be proud of myself for having the discipline to do it, for putting the work in. You know, fortunately, it didn't turn out like that. But the writing of it in itself was a process that I was incredibly proud of. And then, you know, I'm proud of the book as well.
In terms of the book, so the characters, I can well imagine that hanging out with those characters and knowing you're going to keep coming back to them and that there's another book, and then I'm sure another book. It's certainly with my media hat on, my media exec hat on, I can see that it's enormously franchisable. I can see why Spielberg wants the rights. And I'm sure you didn't write it cynically, but I can see exactly where, you know, who it's appealing to. And it's a very broad audience and it can run and run. But you are writing you're writing about a sort of a community of people in their 70s and some older, and you're writing in part through the voice of a white older woman protagonist. Is it as a middle-aged white man writing as a 70 something woman?
But turns out who knew, we're not so very different. People say, how do you get inside the... I think I have the brain of a 75 year old woman, I think.
And perhaps the body as well, since lockdown. I don't know. I can't see
exactly.
The jumper.
Pretty, that's why I'm wearing the jumper. you know, there's four main characters in this book. And Joyce, the one you're talking about, does narrations, he sort of writes a diary. And whenever I'm struggling at all, my agent will say to me, write a Joyce chapter. And it's because it flows out of me, because she thinks the way I think. So it turns out that I clearly have the thought process of a 75-year-old woman, which is a good thing to have. I suppose it's like having a, you know, an 8-year-old boy, 75-year-old woman. And, you know, she does lots of free association. She's always going off on a tangent. You know, she can talk about serious things or silly things, you know. And honestly, I found it easy. I didn't really think about the male-female thing. And I'm really chuffed that people have liked the way I've written women, which is good. I didn't really think about it as I was doing it. I just wrote people, the voices in my head are very real. And, you know, felt like people I might have known. So I honestly, it's the best voice in the world to write in, because she can feign ignorance about pretty much anything, but also she can have wisdom about everything as well. So she's a wonderful character to write.
I'm glad you said that you found it very easy to inhabit her, and in some ways you feel you are a 75-year-old woman, because knowing you a bit as I do, that she's probably the character where you most came across, and where she had those. She's funny, and she does funny. She kind of does funny by stealth, and I found there were lots of things in exactly that style of sort of, well, I'm going to go along seeming to go this way, but actually there's something else going on over here that you might not have noticed, but it's quite important. So I did like the way that she and you seem to be slightly on the Venn diagram of Joyce. I thought there was a smattering of overlap, which I liked a lot.
A big crossover, yeah.
And I just want to ask you before I ask you the three questions I ask everybody at the end of the podcast. There's quite a lot. You have turned 50. Not sure we mentioned that, Richard, but you're 50 now. And so you've got you're at sort of midlife turning point, and you've spent your last couple of years immersed in a retirement village for the purposes of writing your novel that's set in one. And there were quite a lot of quite big existential questions in the Thursday Murder Club. It sort of very much takes on life, death, aging head on. And I did wonder how much of that was a sort of catharsis for you coming to terms with being at a certain point in your life and sort of maybe standing at the top of the hill now, and we can start to see the view down the hill again, can't we, age-wise?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, listen, there's come to a certain point in your life where you understand that you're going to die. You understand in your head. You kind of go, oh, so hold on. This is not just, oh, I'm going to get a better job, and then I'm going to compete, and then this is going to happen, and then I'm going to have a family, and then I'm going to get a slightly bigger house. At some point, it just stops, right? So there's a point where intellectually you understand that. And then I think there's a point where you emotionally really understand it, and you feel it in your heart and in your bones. And that's certainly the case with me. It certainly has been for a few years, where you really get that there's nothing there. This is all we have. You know, it's a finite space and it's a finite time. And so your sort of priorities change a little bit in terms of trying to make the world a slightly better place, and in trying to sort of heal things rather than, you know, divide things. So I feel like I didn't do any of that deliberately in the book, but certainly my brain is full of the joy of the fact that life is finite. And I think there is a joy to that fact, as well as a sadness to it.
It's a bit of a bombshell when you realise that the human condition is terminal, though, isn't it? You sort of think, oh, I've got a free pass. That happens to other people. And then you start seeing things and think, oh, shit. I keep looking at my hands and thinking, oh, my God, I remember my grandma's hands looking like that and thinking she was really old.
I don't know this, but my kids are 22 and 20. And sometimes I walk past people in the street, families, and they've got kids who are sort of 1 and 3 and stuff like that, as my kids were.
And you think, you poor buggers.
Well, I think that. But B, I think, well, that's very old-fashioned. That seems weird that that's still going on. Business of people going, oh, we're going to have kids. You think, I don't know what you're doing. What do you think the end game is here? So what you think you're, because I'll tell you now, they'll get older, then they're going to have kids of their own, and it's just going to carry on, and you'll love them, and that's fantastic. But there's no great story to be told here. You know, it's just, you know, someone has some kids, and then they have some kids, and then they have some kids, and then you do, you know, who do you think you are? That's all that's going on.
The life according to Richard Osman is, although you've gone against type, haven't you? Because a lot of men your age might not be appropriate age dating, and might well have gone again with a second family. So that's right. That's all the rage, isn't it? We have one of those. Our blended family has a child of a, and my kids have a little brother who's a sort of generation away from them.
When people my age are having kids, I'm like, oh God, what are you doing?
I know. Can you imagine how knackered you? I mean, I look at now. I used to be sort of very broody back in the days when I had my kids, and I absolutely best thing I've ever done having kids, hardest and best.
Yeah.
But I now look at people with little kids, and I think, shit. If you only know, it's not the bits everyone tells you are going to be hard, but those, particularly the age hours are now actually in their 20s, when you're sort of hoping that you might have spat them out into the world, able to be adult humans, and watching them and thinking, God, I can't just get in and solve stuff for them. This is, I'm finding this about the hardest stage there's ever been as a parent.
Yeah, no, our friends have all got that. I just honestly, every time I see a 50-year-old guy with a young kid, I think, oh my God, what with my knees? I just I don't think I could do it.
Maybe you should start with that on your dating profile. What would you pick as your namaste motherfucking moment that changed your life?
I would think. It's a tricky one, but that imposter syndrome thing is interesting because obviously I always felt that. And I got a job in telly out of a newspaper. I didn't know anyone who worked in TV or anything like that. So I got this job as a researcher on a computer games program for Sky in the early 90s. And I didn't know anything about the world. I was very, very, I was at 21. I was all over the place. So I didn't know anything. I turned up in that building. I thought, oh, so this is, this is work, right? This is what people do. This is the job. And the second people started talking about the TV program we were about to make, I just thought, oh, you don't watch television. Oh, you don't know anything about this. Oh, I spent the last 16 years watching TV. And I know the answer to these. I'll keep it to myself for now because no one likes a smart ass on first day. Genuinely thought, this is what you've been training for. You know, this is a job you can actually do. Someone's going to pay you for this. And, you know, if you just keep your head down, you could probably do this forever. So I think that the moment was seeing how little people who were clearly very successful knew about what they were doing. And I just thought, oh, well, I'm going to fit right in here. I can bring something to the party. And I've always tried to bring something to the party ever since. I've always tried to make someone more money than they pay me. It's all I've ever wanted to do an honest day's work. For a proper day's pay.
It's also a good thing for us to tell everybody in terms of a work, yes, make people more than they pay you, and chances are you'll have a job for as long as you want it. It's interesting that it's such a basic thing, isn't it, that people need to watch TV if they want to work in it. But lots of people who work in television think they're better. They think they're bigger and better than the people they're making the television shows for. And that's where I think you end up not appealing to the mainstream, because you're going at it from a theoretical, strategic point of view instead of something that might actually work. So basically, kids, watch television for 16 years and the world will be your oyster. I think that's the life advice.
Well, or play games, or, you know, or you know, do YouTube stuff. If it's what you love, then you can have a job doing it. So, you know, I was always told to watch less telly when I was growing up. And you think, well, look at me now, Mum. The heart wants what it wants, doesn't it?
I'm going to go downstairs and tell my son to play more Dungeons and Dragons as soon as we finish this. What is your favourite joke?
Oh, there's a joke. I was fortunate enough to do the, I'm sorry, I haven't the clue live tour just before lockdown, with lovely Timbert Taylor, who's now no longer with us, and Miles Jupp and various other people, lovely Jack D. And we had to do a joke as we went on stage for every show. And so I'll do the joke of the day, because I always got a laugh. I don't know why. And I would say, oh, I've just got back from skiing. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was at the top of the slope and didn't know whether to go zigzag, zigzag, or zag, zig, zag, zig. So I saw this guy, he's dressed in all the kits. I said, excuse me, mate, couldn't I help you? Could you? I want to go down the hill, but I don't know whether to go zig, zag, zig, zag, or zag, zig, zag, zig. And he said, sorry, I can't help you, I'm a tobogganist. I said, oh, well, in that case, can I have 20 Benson and Hedges? I mean, you know, it went down well in the theatres of Britain.
It's funny because I know you've we've talked about jokes and you've always said that you wouldn't want to be a stand-up, that you would hate to do that, but well delivered. That was a marvellous delivery you made. And if there was one bit of life advice you could give to anybody listening, what would it be?
Oh, God, don't listen to anybody, right?
Perfect ending, yeah.
What's the point? Listen, you'll be fine. Keep your head down. Work hard. Be nice to people. Oh, I'll tell you one piece of advice. If you find someone more talented than you, work with them.
Namaste, motherfucker. That was the brilliant Richard Osman. Now, every episode, I pick a thing inspired by my guest that I'm going to try. Anyone who follows Richard on Twitter will know that he is the master of the droll one, or sometimes two, liner. He makes it look very easy. So this week, I'm going to dive into Judd Apatow's recent masterclass, 10 Tips to Improve Your Stand-Up Comedy Writing. There's a link to the article and video in the show notes, and it includes writing a 30-second set, which actually sounds pretty bloody hard, a 2-minute set, and a 5-minute set. As comedians, we've all got loads of strong pre-pandemic material, but those of us who do observational stuff have run a little bit dry of things to observe, given that literally fuck all happens every day, and it's the same fuck call every day. So I'm hoping it will generate some new material for when the comedy venues open again, which is allegedly any day now. On which note, I just want to mention saving live comedy. 50% of all workers in the comedy industry have lost over half of their annual income. 81% say their mental health has been negatively impacted by job uncertainty. 50% have given serious thought to leaving comedy because of the pandemic, rising to 60% for people of colour. Support the people that make live comedy happen so they can keep making you laugh. Donate now via the Save Comedy link in the show notes. Thanks so much to Richard for joining me. Links to all his good stuff are in the show notes, as always. And sorry, motherfuckers, once again, for the very poor audio quality at times during this episode. If you're listening to this, you've done very well. You got to the end, you persevered. I hope you felt it was worth it. And I promise you, normal service will be resumed as of next week. Namaste, Motherfuckers was written and presented by me, Callie Beaton, with music by Jake Yap, and produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. If you'd like today's show, please subscribe now on your favourite podcast app, and also rate and review the show. Not because I'm needy and crave external affirmation, although those things are true, but because it does help other people find the show. We'll be back in your feed next Monday when I'll be talking to QI Elf and co-host of the hit podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, Dan Schreiber.
In America, there are over 300 women whose names are spelled A, B, C, D, E, and that's their first name.
I'm Callie Beaton. Until next time, motherfuckers.
Namaste, motherfuckers.
Pod People.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.